Okay. Do any of you have any questions or anything you want to kind of talk about? Yes.
Are you
going to
come out with a study?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I don't believe in those study guides. You know why not? Because people use it as a substitute for taking the class seriously. They think that, oh, well, everything that's important is going to be on the study guide. No, I want you guys to make a certain effort rather than have everything served up to you on a silver platter. But if you have questions, you know, feel free to, bring them up in class or talk to me after class or come to office hours. But I want you to kind of take the initiative, right? That's the... I used to do it that way, but it didn't work. Anything else? Yeah. Everything I had to say about that, I said in the very first class. So go back and listen to the tape of the very first class. Also, in the syllabus, I kind of describe it. It's sort of either you know it or you don't, right? I don't believe in essay questions because it's just like an invitation for the students to just BS their way through. But this is, there'll be a question of like the important things that we've covered in the class, and it's not just so that you will learn the facts by rote, but it's a way of kind of testing whether you've grasped some of the basic kind of conceptual points. So that, for example, you should know that the Peace Without Victory speech was given before the United States entered the war, and then American policy changed very dramatically after the United States entered the war. So that if I give you in the chronology, America enters World War I and Peace Without Victory speech, if you think the Peace Without Victory speech came after the U.S. entered the war, I know that you don't get. So that's the way I can assess how well you've absorbed things with a kind of a in a fairly objective way. Okay? Anything else? All right. Okay, good. Where are we so far in this class? We're concerned with this great conceptual question of how international conflict is to be understood. And I've talked a number of times about the fundamental issues there. This whole issue of, is war to be understood in terms of aggression? Is regime type of fundamental importance? Is it the case you have trouble when, there are these kind of undemocratic regimes that are in control of the foreign policy of great nations? And if we have a system that the democracies dominate, and everything's going to be all nice and smooth, you know? That whole set of notions, which are kind of very basic in American political culture, certainly, those notions were challenged. You asked me before about the kinds of things I'm going to ask you. One of the main things I'm going to ask you is about what the core argument of various readings that you've done is. So not the Sontag book, which is just given to you for background, not because he develops an argument there, but the other things that you read, like the Cannon article and my thing about the July crisis. What's the bottom line? What's the core of the argument there? And the Cannon piece. Oh, look, God wants the Cannon. Why don't you just stick that thing there? Great, thanks. The Cannon article is of very fundamental importance because it embodies this realist critique of the whole Wilsonian philosophy, right? The whole liberal philosophy. What's the realist critique? It's like saying, it doesn't matter whether a country's a democracy or not a democracy. All these countries are subject to these pressures resulting from the fact that they find themselves in this world where their security is not kind of guaranteed by supranational authority. That if they get into trouble, they're going to have to rely on themselves. And that basic fact shapes the sorts of policies they pursue. They have to be concerned with what would happen if there were a war. They have to be concerned with the structure of power in the world, right? And those concerns about the structure of power normally play a fundamental role, indeed a legitimate role, a natural role in shaping the foreign policy of great nations, right? And you get into trouble when you ignore those things, when you try and suppress them or sweep them under the rug. You see, that was the problem with Wilson, not that his heart was in the wrong place. He obviously wanted peace, wanted a democracy, all the good stuff. But, you know, the subtext of the Kennan article is that, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. All right. What's the importance of this kind of realist critique? Does it explain everything? When you look at the arguments made by famous realist international relations theorists, people like Kenneth Waltz, that I'm sure a lot of you were exposed to in PolySci 20, this whole notion of that's the structure. That's of fundamental importance in determining state behavior. Not that it explains everything. Obviously, it doesn't, but the claim is it explains a lot more than a lot of people think, right? This stuff counts for a lot more than people think, right? So the power of the realist approach is that it sensitizes you to the importance of things that you otherwise might not take sufficiently into account. You know, it counts for more than people think. And it's a very powerful way of looking at things. And we tried to bring a lot of these issues down to earth, and by looking at historical interpretations with which they have a certain affinity, interpretations about the First World War, peace of 1919, what happened in the immediate post-war period, what happened during the Locarno period. Each of these fundamental theories of how international politics works is associated with a particular interpretation of the history of the period that we've been examining. And what do you find when you look at that history? Well, like last time, we were looking at the Locarno period. And the Wilsonian view, the liberal view, the view that was very common at the time, this was the view that after a period of turbulence in the early 1920s, the major European powers, the Western powers, Britain and France, but also Germany, managed to kind of work things out. They were putting... they turned a new leaf, and they were putting their relations with each other on a much more stable basis. The threat of a new war had receded dramatically. These countries were all democracies. The leaders of all these countries were not just narrow nationalists out to advance their own national interests, but they were good Europeans. They thought of Europe as having a certain... claims on their policy that went beyond the pursuit of kind of parochial national interest, right? The realist view is that countries remain concerned with their security. They remain concerned with with the structure of power, with the importance of building up their power, and. Instead of looking at the interwar period as determined by ideological factors, domestic political factors, instead of looking at the interwar period as sharply divided between the 1920s and the 1930s, where by the late 1920s, everything was okay, and it was only because of this kind of political earthquake caused by the Great Depression, which brought the Nazis to power in Germany, that you had a new war, right? Absent that, everything would have been fine, right? That's Stresemann, maker of German policy in the late 1920s, good European. one winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, all that kind of thing. It turned out that when the diplomatic documents relating to German policy during the late 1920s fell into the hands of the Allies after Germany's defeat in World War II, especially the Stresemann papers, it turned out that all that had just been a big myth, that Stresemann had not pursued a policy of being a good European. He was a German nationalist. He still thought in terms of throwing off the Versailles constraints, building up German power, and then once German power was built up, then Germany can insist on fairly far-reaching changes in the status quo, which would make Germany by far the most powerful country in Europe. Right? That there was more continuity between the 20s and 30s than we had been led to believe, that there was a fundamental structural problem in Europe having to do with German power, which had not been resolved during the Locarno period, and that you see this whole process unfolding before Hitler comes to power. The key events are the removal of Allied military control from Germany in 1927, the removal, well ahead of schedule, of the Allied troops from the Rhineland in 1930, and then December 1932, the month before Hitler came to power in Germany, December 1932, the Allies grant Germany equality of rights in matters of armament. Germany's free to rearm, basically. Okay? Before Hitler comes to power. Indeed, before the Depression even strikes. It's clear that the fundamental problem had not been resolved. The French are aware of this. They know that Germany had not been reconciled to the status quo. And, you know, Locarno or no Locarno, they were afraid of what would happen once Germany rebuilt her power. And had, in 1929, decided to build this great line of fortifications across northern France, the Maginot Line. Why would they build that if they weren't afraid of new German threat? Right? More continuity than we had been led to believe. It's the evidence of the power of the realist theory, or it's not actually theory, it's kind of a sensibility that about what really matters in international politics. This sort of thing, power considerations, play a more important role than a lot of other people are prepared to admit. We should place those sorts of considerations front and center. Okay, all very important conclusions. But still, you know, a red flag should go up. You don't want to push that realist theory too far. It doesn't explain everything. No realist scholar would say that it did. It counts. Those things count for more than people think, but they don't count for everything, right? And again, this period that we're concerned with is a very important case in point. Yes, there's continuity in German foreign policy from the 20s to the 30s. Yes, there's a certain degree of continuity between Stresemann and Hitler. But the fact that that's the case, you know, for the reasons that realist scholars emphasize, shouldn't blind us to the fact that there are differences, enormous differences, huge differences between Stresemann and Hitler. Differences in two areas. One having to do with what the ultimate goals are, for Hitler was far, far more radical in terms of what he contemplated than Stresemann. And the second difference had to do with diplomatic style. How fast do you go? You know, what sort of risks do you take? You know, do you move ahead only when, you know, the deck is stacked in your favor and you could achieve your goals without undue risk of a war? Or are you a gambler? Do you kind of push ahead almost regardless of risk? Right? I don't want to say that Hitler was in that second category, but far more in that direction than as Dresden was. Okay, very important in two regards. So today we want to take a look at what the Nazi policy was, the Hitler policy, which plays the dominant role in shaping European politics from the time Hitler came to power in Germany in January of 1933 through the 1930s, through the outbreak of war in September of 1939, and indeed even into the war itself. How is the Nazi policy to be understood? To understand it, you just have to go back to the Darwinian Revolution and European thought in the 19th century, the enormous intellectual breakthrough we associate with the with Charles Darwin and the whole Darwinian philosophy is applied not just to the natural world but to the human world as well. What's the basic idea there? Is that evolution, including evolution, has to be viewed in material terms. That is to say that moral considerations do not come into play in shaping the way the evolutionary process runs its course. Whatever contributes to survivability in the sense of reproductive advantage, that's what you're going to find, regardless of how amoral or immoral those traits might appear to be. If they give the organisms in which the genetic material that determines those traits reside a reproductive advantage, that's what you're going to find, no matter how violent it is. This whole vision of nature red in tooth and claw, where evolution is determined by the survival of the fittest in the sense of whatever creates reproductive advantage. This is the essence of the Darwinian theory as applied both to nature and then even by Darwin himself to human evolution. Okay, very, very important way of looking at things. A totally different way of looking at things from the earlier religion-based approaches of the essence of humanity. Right? Now, the interesting thing that scholars have discovered who've looked at this stuff is that the implications of the Darwinian philosophy about human behavior, that violence is kind of built into the human condition, that's normal, that's natural, that what this means is that in the long run, you will not be able even to provide for your own security unless you acquire an adequate territorial base that could enable you to kind of create the resources that would enable you to withstand pressures from the outside, because everyone else is behaving in this amoral way, kind of with traits designed to achieve reproductive advantage. You have to take the whole goal of acquiring an adequate territorial base seriously, because otherwise you're just going to be crushed in the long run over the course of centuries. Okay. And the use of force to achieve those goals is legitimate because it's natural. This is what's built into human evolution. Right? Those ideas, which are quite shocking ideas, right? They seem, on a certain level, to be logical implications of the basic Darwinian philosophy. There's only one country in Europe that embraces those ideas more or less wholeheartedly. Darwin himself holds back. In England, in France, in the United States, people hold back from accepting that philosophy with all of its implications. Not so in Germany. In Germany, Darwinism is accepted, in terms of its human dimensions, much more wholeheartedly than in the West. Now, that's part of the political culture of Germany before World War I, and it's that's part of the context in which German policy, as it's pursued in a kind of half-assed way before the war, is part of the context in which German policy has to be understood. Right? But you find elements of that throughout the West. The whole phenomenon of imperialism has to be understood in that context. Right? And yet, after World War I, there's a change in the West. People move away from those notions, those notions which have this this overtone of war is natural, the use of force is normal, violence is an integral part of the system, this is the nature of the international system, so on. The First World War was so horrible that people kind of pulled back and said, there's got to be another way. Right? We got to look for ways of just getting everyone to kind of accept things as they are, accept the status quo. War is an instrument of policy. It's evil. Right? That's the direction that thinking is moving in the Western countries. Not so in Germany. You know, the Germans blamed their troubles not on the war itself, but on the fact that they had lost. And this was a fundamental difference and had a profound effect shaping the thinking, not of all Germans by any means, but of a lot of them. Right? The Nazi phenomenon has to be understood in that context. What is the basic goal of Hitler and the Nazi movement? To transform the whole international political structure very radically by providing Germany with an adequate territorial base to support a massive population, which will enable Germany to become not just the world power, but probably in the long run, the dominant world power. Right? The goal is domination. Where is that land going to come from? Through conquest. Conquest in the east. Conquest in the direction of the Ukraine. This whole area here to the east. Ultimately, its existing population, first enslaved, then wiped out. And those areas settled by Germans, you know, part of this huge, massive German empire, which would be so enormous that it could generate the military resources with which to aspire to world hegemony. Ultimately, the ultimate showdown would be between Germany and the United States in this worldview. Very, very clearly, the America factor is a very important element of this entire philosophy. Okay? There's a big problem here. If you have goals like this, how are you going to hope to achieve them? Your resources are limited. I should just say in passing, there's a terrific book that came out on the Nazi period. It's one of the things that's had the most profound impact on my own understanding of this period. It's by a British scholar named Adam Tooze, T-O-O-Z-E. Did I have it there? No. And it's called The Wages of Destruction, and the subtitle is The Rise and Fall of the Nazi War Economy. And his whole insight is Germany is not a wealthy country. Germany is a relatively poor country. And given what Germany is aspiring to, she's going to need a lot in the way of military resources. And how are you going to squeeze those military resources out of an economy like that? Right? Especially when you take into the fact that ultimately Germany is aspiring to win a war with the United States. This basic problem, limited German resources in comparison with extremely ambitious German goals, this creates this enormous problem. How are you going to achieve those goals given the limits on your power? Right? You want to squeeze out every last drop of military power from the resources that you have. But even so, when you're moving ahead and you're mobilizing a whole country, and Hitler said all these things in Mein Kampf and so on, doesn't it stand to reason that other countries are going to sit up and take notice? You know, and especially the Soviet Union? Doesn't, as in fact they do. And also Britain and France, how are they, you know, if Germany achieves her goals and becomes a European hegemon like that and develops this kind of massive power, then Britain and France at best will be reduced to the status of German satellites. That's the end of their freedom. They'll be too weak to stand up to Germany. Right? They'll certainly be able to see that coming. And if they see that coming, they're not just going to wait until it happens. They'll take countermeasures while those countermeasures are still manageable. This is you know, the basic problem, the basic assumption. The Nazis, when they take power, they think that there's a real danger of France launching a preventive war against Germany. How could they not do it, given what Hitler said in his famous book Mein Kampf? You know, it's like right out there in public. Enormous problem for German diplomacy. You know, especially in the early period when Germany's still weak. Yeah, there had been all the secret rearmament, but there were limits to what Germany could do in the 1920s. Right? Now Germany has embarked on a massive rearmament campaign. It's well known to the other powers what Germany is up to. Won't they realize that they had to move before it was too late? And so, once Germany was able to build up her power to a certain level, there would no longer be any fear of a preventive war, of the Allies moving against Germany. But they didn't know that at the time. So they felt that they had to kind of go through this danger zone while their power was still being built up, you know, to worry about what the other powers would do. And so Hitler, during this period, adopts a very cautious policy. It's not full speed ahead in the sense of an open revolt against the Versailles system. He takes a whole series of measures designed to limit the risks that Germany would have to go through while she's passing through the danger zone, while her policy is still, while her power is still being built up to the point where the West couldn't really contemplate the use of military force against Germany. And so what do they do? Well, he gives all these speeches about his hatred for war. He's a veteran of the First World War. He knows what a war is. All he wants is for Germany to regain her self-respect, you know, for Germany, you know, to acquire the position that is due her without being subject to this outrageous charge that Germany had been uniquely responsible for having caused the First World War. You know, Germany has a moral right to reality, but beyond that, you know, he just wants peace. And he does all these things to kind of suggest that the rhetoric is one thing, the actual substance of German policy was rather different. The traditional diplomats are still left in power. The German Foreign Office is run by not a Nazi, but by a someone from the traditional school. Baron von Neurath, his name was. And you enter into all these negotiations to settle issues on a bilateral basis. And in fact, the Nazis achieve a kind of entente with Poland. Poland is then under a military dictatorship. I should say, just in passing, that the Poles don't have any problem with Nazi anti-Semitism. And the Polish foreign minister tells his German counterpart that if Hitler was able to solve the Jewish problem, they would build a monument to him in Warsaw. You know, this. Poland had been an ally of France. Now it seemed that Poland was kind of moving into the German orbit a bit. There's a concordat with the Vatican, which gives the German regime a certain international legitimacy. The Germans in 1935 make a naval agreement with the British, accepting British naval superiority vis-a-vis Germany. You know, all of these things suggest that, that Germany is playing the traditional game. Germany is adjusting to you know, political realities. If you read Mein Kampf, Hitler says that there was a big problem with German policy before World War I. Not that it was excessively ambitious in terms of its ultimate goals. The problem was that these people didn't have a coherent strategy. That the policy that they pursued ended up at putting Germany at odds with the three next most important powers in Europe, all at the same time, with Russia, with France, and with Britain, all at the same time. It says that makes no sense at all. What you want to do is isolate your adversaries and deal with them one by one. How successful was this policy of just kind of pulling the wool over the eyes of the Allies? Half successful. I mean, the Russians certainly understood how serious a threat the Nazis were posing. And the whole Stalinist phenomenon in Russia in the 1930s has to be understood in that context, in the context of the growing German threat. Why do you have Stalinism? You know, it's a huge emphasis on building up Soviet industrial power, you know, through any means necessary, you know, squeezing the rural population so as to extract that agricultural surplus from them through the most violent terror tactics imaginable, because you needed that extra food in order to feed these workers that are building up your industrial base so that you would be able to face the German threat. I mean, insofar as there's a defense of Stalinism to present day, that's the way it's defended. Given the rising German threat, the Soviets had to do whatever was necessary to prepare themselves to deal with it. What about the Western powers, though? The French foreign minister, his name was Barthou, right? I have it over there, Louis Barthou, 1934 this is. He understands the German threat, but the sense is you can't really use force against Germany. You invade Germany, then what? Can you really hold a knife to a country that's much stronger than you are, basically? The French don't really quite believe that they're up to that task, especially since the British are not going to be behind them in this. The best that they could do, according to Barthou, is to build up a massive coalition of all the other powers in Europe that would be designed to contain Germany. All right, so that's the Barthou strategy, containment. You know, massive coalition. And that would include, with France as the core, but also fascist Italy, which was threatened by the rise of German power. Don't forget that. You know, Italy had made certain territorial acquisitions at the expense of Austria, which at the end of World War I, which included a certain German-speaking population. You know, Italy would lose her independence in a German-dominated Europe. It was not absurd to think that Italy would join in an anti-German policy. As a matter of fact, in 1934, when the local Nazis in Austria tried to take over that country and merge it into Germany, and they assassinated the Austrian chancellor at that time, Dollfuss, these attempts were pushed back because Mussolini actually mobilized some divisions on the Brenner Pass between Italy and Austria, threatening intervention rather than to let this happen. So bringing Italy into this coalition, not a problem for Barthou, because power considerations played the central role, not a country's internal political system. And conversely, also you're going to bring in the Soviet Union, because obviously the Soviets were deeply threatened, and the French embark on negotiations with the Soviets, which were to lead to the conclusion of the Franco-Soviet Pact in 1935. Right? So it seems like the Soviets can be brought in. They know who the real threat is. They're going to be looking for friends in the West in the event that the German problem comes to a head. Right? Ideology, whether communists or fascists, not a problem for Barthou, But the main ally, the most important ally for France is, of course, Great Britain. And there's this hope that Britain would cooperate with this general policy. A little reluctantly, because the British were convinced that the old policy of arms and alliances that Barthou seemed to want to continue, this was not a solution. It had been a part of the problem before World War I, right? You have to understand the role that historical analysis or historical perceptions played in this whole story in the 1920s. This whole question of who would cause the war, fundamental importance, right? The Versailles system, which was aimed at depriving Germany of political equality, keeping Germany down. There was a moral basis for that, and that was with the idea that the Germans had caused the war. They were still responsible for the war, right? You have a conception which holds Germany responsible for the war, and thus for, you know, for the main, a conception which holds that Germany has to be kept down. You're never going to have a solid peace. You know, you're never going to have real reconciliation once you stigmatize Germany as this kind of criminal nation that had caused this terrible catastrophe. So there's a real incentive to move away from those notions that, oh, the Germans, or for that matter, anybody had caused the war. So instead of saying anyone had caused the war, you say no one really caused it. It just kind of happened. It's like kind of a natural disaster, hurricane, earthquake, whatever. You know, it's all these kind of impersonal forces that pulled people, into the abyss without them knowing what was going on. The arms race, the alliance system, you know, the old diplomacy. Thinking in terms of power, you know, we have to put all that stuff behind us because that had been part of the problem, right? And the historian said some notion Germany had caused the war, you know, it's childish. It was much more complicated than that. It was a situation that doesn't really lend itself to those sorts of simple formulae, right? So the British are very kind of reluctant to kind of contemplate a policy of the use of force against Germany, even in the final analysis. Reluctant to kind of get involved. Okay? That's one problem with the Barthou strategy. But the more basic problem is a structural weakness. Oh yeah, containment, this huge block of all the other powers in Europe arrayed against Germany. This is fine when Germany's weak. But the strategy does nothing to keep Germany from building up her power. And once Germany becomes strong, then how is any of this stuff going to come into play? Okay? What if Germany becomes strong and builds up her defenses in the West and then decides that she wants to rectify the border in the East and Czechoslovakia, Poland, whatever, into the German power block. Then what is the West going to do? They have this big problem. Don't forget, this is a period of depression in the West. Not so in Germany. The Nazi armaments policies created a boom in the German economy, full employment in the German economy. But in the West are still in depression, meaning that tax receipts have fallen off. On the other hand, social welfare expenses have risen, and there's just a whole lot less for armaments than there would otherwise have been. And whatever there is for armaments goes for, in the case of France, for defense rather than for offensive forces that could be used against Germany in the event that Germany moves east, right? Everything's going like to the Maginot Line. There were a couple of hands. You had a hand up. What was whose population? I don't know offhand, but Russia, the Russian population is much, much larger than that of any of these countries. I don't imagine something in the order of 150 million, offhand, I would say. In terms of its military power, growing very rapidly in terms of the military economic base, because the whole emphasis of Stalin is on building heavy industry, you know, iron, steel, that's the core of the Stalinist industrialization policy in the 1930s. Yes?
From the books from the, the beginning of the 1930s, it's quoted that, you know, they went from like 1 million people in the Red Army to like 3.5 million or so, like in a couple of years once they got their system like that.
Yeah. I mean, there were all these problems with the Soviet military because Stalin was paranoid, and he had been fed this false information about how his military leaders were in cahoots with the Germans, and this touched off this great purge of the Soviet military and the officer corps, including some of their most talented officers. They were just decimated. You know, you want to understand why the Soviet Union suffered such severe reverses at the outbreak of the German-Soviet War in June 1941. That's a big part of the answer. Yeah.
Why is Poland so weak?
Why is Poland so weak? Because in terms of population, it's smaller than that of Germany and Russia. In terms of its geography, it has to deal with these two enemies, Germany on the one hand, Russia on the other, who have an interest in collaborating with each other against Poland. And in industrial terms, Poland is not nearly as advanced as the West European countries, and she's not industrializing the way Russia is either. So what Poland can do by herself is very, very little against a powerful modern country like Germany if it's one-on-one. All right. Good point. Poland. What's Poland's hope in the event of a war? Who's going to defend Poland? In principle, the Soviet Union is in this anti-German bloc. But the Poles don't want the Soviets to come onto their territory because their fear is once the Soviets are in, they'll never leave. You know, essentially not a baseless fear. Okay. Yeah, how's France or even Britain and France together gonna get to Poland? You know, this whole system is designed for a period of German weakness, not German strength. Once Germany becomes strong, the system is not going to restrain her. Only by threatening a new world war. But you know, how seriously are the Germans going to take those threats? German feeling is going to be, they didn't do anything to restrain us when we were weak. You know, it's inconceivable that they'll take any serious measures to restrain us now that we're strong. Okay. Problems with the system, with the containment system. And it kind of goes on. As German power rises and as this threat develops, people could see how weak the Western powers were in comparison, how their attentions were going to have to be focused on this rising German threat. But what that meant, that there were opportunities for other countries to take advantage of Western strategic overextension and promote their own interests. So you have Japan embarking on an aggressive policy in the Far East. Who's going to restrain them? Not British, right? Mussolini saying, oh, well, we can pursue Italian imperial ambitions in Africa. So you have the Ethiopian War in 1935. Again, very much in this context. You have other powers in Europe shifting, moving more into the German orbit or distancing themselves from the Western powers as they can see which way the wind is blowing. Belgium renounces her alliance with France and moves toward neutrality in 1936. Italy also moves much more into the German sphere. Again, a lot of this has to do with the Ethiopian War. And this whole containment system was very thin. So the Soviets, you know, they're going to have second thoughts about too close an alignment with the Western powers. Why? Because if war breaks out as a result of that policy and the Germans attack the USSR, what is the West going to do to help the Soviets? Right? Not very much that it can do, given that its forces are designed for defense primarily. right? These are very basic problems with this system. Everyone sees this stuff, including the Nazis themselves, right? And so Hitler starts moving ahead. 1935, reintroduces conscription, announces publicly Germany has an air force. And then the big step, 1936, the Germans send their troops into the demilitarized Rhineland, a violation not just of Versailles, you will recall, but also of Locarno, you know, justified by the Franco-Soviet pact, which the Germans view is also implicitly a violation of Locarno. Okay? Why did the Germans do it? Because the Allies had made it clear that they weren't going to do anything in the event that the Germans did something like this. The Germans test the waters. There was all these negotiations about this stuff. I think I put on the website, again, this terrific article by Stephen Schuker about called France and the Remilitarization of the Rhineland. The French give the Germans this warning. Their warning is that if the Germans do anything like this, the French will take the matter to the League of Nations and propose the implementation of economic sanctions. And the German reaction is practically, break out the champagne. If that's all they're going to do, we don't have anything to worry about. And then, you know, that was like right on the eve of the occupation of the Rhineland. Okay. The Germans move into the Rhineland. They can now defend the Rhineland. They start building up their fortifications. This means that they have even less to worry about than they previously had about a French invasion in the event they pursued an active policy in the East. Okay? They can be much more secure in the West, much less vulnerable in the West. And so the remilitarization of the Rhineland is a watershed date in the history of the 1930s. Marks a shift from the relatively cautious policy the Germans had pursued up to that point, from 33 through 36, to a much more active policy, forcing the pace, you know, to take advantage of things before the rest of the world kind of wakes up, right? And so that's the key to understanding what happens 1938 and 1939. So that's what I'm going to be talking about next time. The path to war in September 1939, the great crises of the late 1930s. Okay, thanks.